Test.
Check this out.
Ranger.
Autonomous Action Radio, a multimedia radio show, a website, an idea, a suggestion, an action plan.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Anarchy Show. My name is Linda and we're having a bit of trouble with our onboard computer management system. I know that's my car that's having trouble with its onboard computer management system. Triple Z, we're having trouble with our computer management system for playing songs on the radio. Coming up on today's show, we will be talking about the Black Bloc. There's been lots of speculation in the media about a Black Bloc in Brisbane, with the G20 coming up in a few weeks. Some might say it's already here. And anarchists traditionally oppose any global financial meeting, and in some places Black Bloc tactics are used by anarchists, and they're not used to get attention, which is what one professor, Janet Ranley, she's been on contacted by a lot of different media. And she's a professor at Griffith University in criminology, which is not the best person to ask about the Black Bloc. So that's coming up today. Also talk about Reclaim the Night. We're going to get stuck into the show though.
Take your hand and marry the state.
You just heard from the Resin Dogs and Daily Trouble, and that one came off the album from way back in August 2000. And the reason I played it is that the Resin Dogs were one of the groups performing at the Rally for the Reef on Saturday night at the Brisbane Powerhouse. And a short report back from the Rally for the Reef. There are a number of bands playing. It started at 2 o'clock, and I guess it was just like a gig, kind of probably a bit more hippie than maybe the people that normally go to the Powerhouse, and there were some information stalls right there. I find the whole thing a bit involving a bit of greenwashing.
Well, yes, you know, obviously they're trying to seek the middle ground, and they're desperate, and it's a good cause, though, the Reef. I mean, you
know, yes, yes.
We love the Reef, don't we?
Yes.
You are protected.
Yes, everyone. I mean, I love the planet. I want to protect the whole planet. Not just the Reef.
And it wasn't part of the G20 cultural celebrations, was it?
No.
So there you go. That's a good thing.
Yes, not part of the G20 culture side.
Which is just big and bigger, and it's those monumental things they've got at South Bank. Huge advertising things for it.
Yes.
Three stories high.
It involved, on Saturday, they were having a Day of the Dead celebration, which is co-opting Mexican culture. And at the moment in Mexico, there's 43 students have disappeared from Guerrero.
Yes.
Guerrero. Oh. And there's drug cartels, and it's all really, really
dependent on US demand.
Messy.
The guns come from the south and the drugs go to the north. Yes. It's a terrible situation.
And we're not hearing as much about it in the news as we are about ISIS or Daesh.
Yes.
And perhaps I was thinking, does that have to do with natural resources?
Mm, well, of course. And, of course, it was Halloween, Linda, which I saw in the paper that, the Day of the Dead's got nothing to do with Halloween. Well, actually, I think it does. It's sort of similar, you know, because traditionally Halloween was a pagan period of recognition of the dead. The veil between the living and the dead was, you know, made immaterial, and you know, it was all about that, you know, acknowledging death and dealing with it and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's all there in the mix. And I went to a Halloween gig at Chardon's Corner on Friday, and it was very good. That's a Triple Z friendly venues, $4.50 for a pint, people, and some of the money goes to Triple Z, and it was very good. There was a lot of, you know, young bands I was unfamiliar with, but there was Deputy Dipshit and Kmart Warriors from Victoria, our Plan of Attack. And guess what, people? You just can't get away from it. But the G20 did get a mention a couple of times in one of the acts, one of the more theatrical ones mentioned it. And they're also having a gig on the Friday, the 14th, to escape the G20. But I think you'd have to go further than Annalee to get away from it. But, you know, and another speaker from another band, I can't remember which, was, warning people about opportunistic journalists trying to get, you know, crass copy for the mainstream media, and warning people about that. And mentioning that, you know, there is going to be protests, of course, so that was good. But yeah, there's just been saturation in the media, as Linda mentioned, about Black Bloc and anarchists in particular. We have been name-checked, haven't we, Linda? And we're
smash the G20.
Yes, it's all out there in the particularly the Courier Mail, but also other national media.
The Daily Mail was the worst one, I think, because they took the article from the Courier Mail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk to them.
Mm.
No one talked to them.
Mm.
And then this poster, which the Courier Mail said is an online poster, all of a sudden in the Daily Mail, it's posted all over Brisbane.
I mean, there are posters in Brisbane, I know that.
That's right.
But, of course, it's all in the atmosphere of, well, you know, war on terror and all the stuff that's going on now, beheadings and oppression and everything. But, of course, there has also been a little bit of royalist stuff, hasn't there? Queen Mary or Princess Mary or something, and the Queen texting. And it brought to mind, in my mind, and I know other people's minds because of letters in the media, the connection between the royals and beheading and death and torture. And not that long ago, people, the English royals the punishment for treason was being hung and drawn and quartered. Do you really want to know what that was? And also just, you know, slaughtering the peasants in the field when they, you know, when they acted up. So it's only, you know, 500 years or so since stuff like that was going on. And so, you know, you can make parallels, can't you, between what is going on now from the people like the Caliphate and what was going on not all that long ago in the British Empire. Also, I saw the other day that it's 100 years, Linda, since Australian troops, the Anzacs, left to fight, coincidentally, well, near the Middle East. They were attacking the Turkish Empire on the behest of the British Empire, which was supporting the Russian Empire, which was at war with the German Empire, which was at war with the French Empire. Is there a thread going through all of this? Is there something we can take from this, like empire? You know, that's what was about then, and is it also still in a way what it is about today? You know, the Americans, they have imperial attributes. It's undeniable, and of course this caliphate seems to be an empire in embryo. So it's not that, you know, it's not that this sort of stuff hasn't happened before, but you know, it obviously has different, you know, connotations today to a degree. Well, I think the only principled position, and I think this is a pretty fair assessment of an anarchist position, is to say a plague on both your houses. We will not support any empire at all. I have to say at this point that, you know, Linda, we as anarchists have to own up to a past that included violence. It's well known that there were assassinations carried out by anarchists in the 19th century, but I do have to state that a lot of those were just single targets, leaders, kings, emperors, presidents. And came after great periods of oppression, you know, from those people, especially in Russia with the Tsar, and so it wasn't just coming out of the blue, it wasn't just a personality defect. We people were resisting terrible ongoing oppression, including death and imprisonment and torture, and of course ultimately though all of that stuff failed because people came to realize that more leaders would rise and that you would just make a martyr out of the people that you assassinated, and in a way you would make the state oppression even worse. Not that they really needed an excuse, but that's what happened. So by the 70s, definitely, anarchists had put aside those sort of tactics, and there is a text, I have mentioned it before, The Anarchist Case Against Terrorism, printed by the Libertarian Socialist Organization, which subtitle was You Cannot Blow Up a Social Relationship, because that's our position, that it's about a social relationship that has to be, negotiated and everything. Not that we are pacifists. We reserve the right to defend ourselves, which is what occurred once again in history in Russia in the Civil War, and in Spain in that Civil War and that revolution. But we don't feel ourselves to be, on the attack. We will assert ourselves. We will assert our right to express our dissent, along with, of course, other people. I'd just like to put that out there, people, that, we've gone about what we're on about on this program quite a lot, and even at this time like this, when the pressure is ramping up severely, we will still have our say. What do you say, Linda?
Let's go to a song.
My request?
Yes.
Yes, it's a song called I Got a Beef, and it's going out to all those Hitler hipsters out there who think it's all such a drag.
You wanna try?
And you just heard a few tracks there that Peter's going to tell us about.
Yeah, the first one was Brassy, I Got a Beef, and just putting it out there to all you, you know, cool dudes who don't want to get involved. Well, I got a beef with you. And the second one was the Phobes, and what was that? Everybody's getting 4-3-piece together, which I thought was really, you know, let's get together.
And coming up soon, we're going to be playing our segment on the Black Block. And also, much more importantly, on Friday, it was Reclaim the Night, the annual women's march all over the world in Brisbane. It happened starting at Roma Street Forum and then actually walking across through, I guess, the court area there and over the go-between bridge. No, the...
Grey Street.
No, the walking bridge. Is that the go-between bridge? It was over the Goodwill Bridge. That's right. The Goodwill Bridge. And I'd say there'll be between 50 and 100 people there. I think I kind of underestimate things. So, and I was looking at a picture and there were actually quite a few people there.
Many police?
No. No, there were...
Busy somewhere else.
Yeah, there were just a few police there at the beginning, and then on the other side in Karupa Park, which is where the more speeches, and there was a bit of a little thing happening over there. There were one police van and a few police. I don't know, I went to get dinner last night, and there were two police cars pulled up and also police on bicycles rode past. Not that I'm paranoid.
I saw a B105 promotion today, Linda, coming here.
Yes.
There was all these people in their underwear. I don't know what it was. It was freaky. And then when I coming back, and there was heaps of police milling around where they had been.
Brisbane. Australia's new world city.
Oh, yes.
So that's what's coming up. We're just working on a few technical issues before we can play those, but we have some vinyl lined up. Peter, what is it?
It's a Warumpi band, a great band from a few years ago, No Fear.
And there's going to be lots of things happening as far as the Aboriginal community is concerned.
Gather in Musgrave Park.
And a few marches as well. You're on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM.
He was fear, everything is clear. We have no 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 fear.
And that was the Rumpy Band with We Have No Fear. This is the Aniki Show, Autonomous Action Radio. We're going to talk about the Black Bloc now, or rather our friend Franklin Lopez from Submedia is going to take us through the Black Bloc, including an interview with a person who has written a book who fears the Black Bloc. Are you afraid of the Black Blocs? And you don't have anything to be afraid of from the Black Bloc, unless maybe you are a policeman or a police car or a window in from Starbucks. As Peter mentioned earlier, anarchists, violence or so-called violence is in self-defense, and some people say that anarchists going Black Bloc would cause people to be attacked by the police, but I'd say that actually if you're being effective protesting, you're going to get attacked by the police. I've experienced it myself, because you're doing something that is disrupting them, and they'll do whatever it takes, because that's the job, that's their job. And so if you're doing something that is effective, like blockading, for instance, the blockade of the World Economic Forum in 2000, I was there, I experienced it, the police are going to come out with full force to break up that blockade, and the fact that you're unarmed is of no concern to them. I'm going to play this segment on the Black Bloc right now. Hear it straight from the horse's mouth.
A lot of people involved in the Black Bloc on Saturday, many of them 6 months ago, were members of the Labour Party, working for the Liberal Democrat Party, people who really believed back then that parliamentary democracy could work for them. And now they believe that it's not going to work for them.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, the show where all our heroes wear masks.
Go ninja, go ninja, go! 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 Go, 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 go!
I am your host, Stimulator, and with global May Day protests and the Occupy wave of actions coming up, I thought it would be nice to do a little segment about the tactic of tactics. The cancer in Chris Hedges' colon.
Too big to fail, big enough to fall.
The most widespread and mimicked street formation of the last 6,000 years.
Okay.
And the craze that has police departments and politicians wetting their dockers. Yep.
The Black Bloc.
The underpinnings of this movement are confrontational and radical.
Many people out there think that the Black Bloc is a gang or crew that one can join.
The radical group called the Black Bloc anarchists openly brag about using terrorist type tactics.
There are no Black Bloc anarchists, you dick no shit rocket. The Black Bloc is simply a fucking tactic.
Black Bloc is not a group or a social movement. It's simply a tactic used by protesters to protect themselves from police aggression and express a complete rejection of capitalism.
Tactics are techniques used for securing objectives and are part of a strategy or plan of action.
Like the tactic of blockading a street. The blockade is used with the objective of stopping police or industry traffic into an area that you are trying to hold or protect, and could be part of an overall strategy to protect a forest or autonomous zone, for example. The Black Bloc tactic can be used for the purpose of securing streets, with the strategic goal of creating autonomous spaces for dissent within the context of intense police repression. It can also be used to attack corporate and state infrastructure, allowing the saboteurs to remain anonymous. This tactic has spread around the world like wildfire, and we have witnessed its prowess in places such as Turkey, Egypt, Brazil, and Colombia. So, to find out more about the history of the Black Bloc, I bring you Francis Dupuy-Dery, a motherfucking anarchist and author of Who's Afraid of the Black Blocs. Hey Francis, how the fuck are you?
I don't know.
When was the tactic of Black Bloc first deployed?
The Black Bloc, the way we know it, appeared the first time in Germany, in West Berlin, at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. The first time the term Black Bloc was coined in Germany was in 1980. And it was in the what was called at the time the Autonomen movement, a movement mainly of squatters, political squatters, who were involved in a protest against the nuclear industries, the nuclear weapons, and the neo-fascist movement in Germany. So at the time in Germany, they were wearing a leather jacket. That was what was fashionable at the time. So black leather jacket, black motorcycle helmet, and they were merging in Black Bloc to get a mass of anonymous people, because you can't recognize people in a homogeneous mass of people wearing black and mask. And they were using this tactic to confront the police, fight against the police which was coming to expose them from their squats, for instance, or to fight against neo-Nazis in the streets.
In the description of your book, Who's Afraid of the Black Blocs, it states that the image of the window-smashing thug hides a complex reality. Can you fucking explain?
Too often the Black Bloc is described by politicians, by police officers, by journalists, by scholars even, as something really not interesting from a political point of view. They are described as a bunch of hooligans and as apolitical individuals who just like to riot, like to smash things without any political rational.
The Black Bloc, which are, you know, primarily white, sort of nihilistic, destructive, you know, embracing sort of confusing petty vandalism and this repellent sort of cynicism with revolution.
And of course, when you listen to them, when you watch them in action, when you look at them, when you follow them, and when you try to understand what they do in Germany, in France, in Great Britain, in Greece, in Brazil, you rapidly understand that it's only about politics.
I heard 50,000 other people were going to be here, and I figured even if they're out here protesting in a way that I don't like, advocating reform or abolition of some particular institution, at least there are 50,000 people that really care and are worked up about something, and hopefully we can come out here and give them a shove in a little more radical direction.
About politics, about economics, of course, also, about power relationship, about domination, and it's a way to express a radical criticism of these systems, the state system, the capitalist system, the bank system, and their targets. What the target is the message. It's what they target that give us the meaning of their action.
Thanks, Francis. Stay tuned after the break for an interview with a Montreal street fighter.
Sortir du silence comme d'un abcès, trouver l'écho, laisser la folie exploser. Ignorer la bas, aller droite à l'opposé, compter parler le fracas. Alerte rouge, parce que le bleu me rend malade. Un rouge profond et dense à la mesure de la brimade. Alerte rouge, parce que le rose est bien trop fade. Mais rouge comme la couleur des théâtres et barricades. Car s'ils savaient ce que je pense de leur mode d'emploi, leur façon de nous la faire à l'enfer et à l'endroit, leur fin sera mon début, c'est bien normal qu'on reste en froid. Je crache mes brûlots de prolo puis disparais après l'envoi. Et j'attends le sabotage, je veux gripper la machine, l'imprévu, le coup du sort, faire valser le décor, je veux dégraisser le port, puis redresser les chines, inverser la vapeur et voir la peur changer de bord. Leur sang criait,
viewers of this fucking show know that in 2012, thousands of people took part in a six-month insurrection in Montreal. What is popularly known as the Maple Spring began as a student strike, but evolved into a popular revolt that included many sectors of society. The sheer fucking number of protesters and the non-stop use of militant street tactics exhausted not only the cops, but also their budget. Since then, the Montreal Popo have smartened up and have consistently kettled anti-capitalist demonstrations as a way to avoid a repeat of 2012. This year, comrades have been having conversations as to how to regain the street power that was obtained on that insurrectionary moment. So, to revisit some of the tactics used in the battles of that year, I bring you Nick, a university student involved in much of the street fighting in 2012. But first, a fucking disclaimer.
The voice of Nick has been replaced with that of a voice actor to protect their identity. Also, some of the footage used to illustrate Nick's experience will not necessarily be from Montreal. This video is meant for entertainment purposes only, much like a sex toy or a novelty whoopee cushion.
So, enough of that noise. Hey Nick, how the fuck are you?
I'm feeling great.
So, how the fuck does street fighting progress in Montreal?
From the beginning of the strike, we saw the use of masks go from being an isolated practice to something that became normal for hundreds of people to do. This explosion in the use of masks wasn't magical. It took anarchists consistently masking up and explaining why they mask up in flyers and conversations. The same can be said for attacks against police. As the strike progressed, the isolated attacks on police that characterized the demos during the beginning of the strike, such as a couple of rocks thrown in their direction, eventually became more popular to do, up to the point where demos sometimes became very uncontrollable for hours. This was simply a matter of persistence.
Fuck! Holy shit!
As people continued to see masked up street fighters getting away with attacking the pigs who had been clubbing them for weeks, they started to see themselves as capable of acting conflictually as well. I imagine that this involved many different groups of friends in the student milieu making plans to come to demos with these intentions for the first time, but also probably involved many people coming by themselves. The tension that could be felt against the police during the strike initially mostly only manifested itself in chants, but over time this transformed into the more empowering practice of attacking police directly. And as more and more people took this up, it snowballed into being normalized.
And what are some of the tactical lessons learned from that period?
When we look at the confrontation with police that we've seen here, it can basically be broken down into two things. Confrontation that frees up space from the police, and confrontation that doesn't have the force to make police retreat, but is still valuable, obviously. From what I've seen, the factors that make projectile attacks, for instance, capable of winning the space, are coordination and widespread participation, with an offensive mentality that doesn't wait for police to attack us first. This is how fear changes camps, avoiding the cycle of police inevitably attacking the demo and dispersing it as everyone runs from police charges. In Montreal, the courage to confront police is already held by many people, but often, the level of self-organization is not quite developed enough to make these confrontations long-lasting. Something that some anarchists quickly realized was that if we want to hold the streets after things start to get wild, projectiles must be collected as soon as possible. During the demos with a more militant tone, like March 15th, the night demos, the book fair weekend, April 25th, May Day, and others, within the first 10 minutes you would see crews running into alleys or gardens to collect rocks in side bags, or using hammers to ply rocks up from the street, or smashing the larger pieces into throwable sizes on the sidewalk. People who had collected rocks would then distribute them amongst the masked portion of the demo. Something that also started to happen more often was people counting down before throwing, so that instead of just one or two rocks actually connecting with police, there were volleys that could make police retreat. Another tactic to accompany rock throwing that has been used pretty extensively is throwing paint bombs, but these often have a limited effect unless aimed well enough to hit a visor. I've seen this happen only once. Fire extinguishers filled with paint, on the other hand, as seen in Oakland during the general strike, are the perfect weapon against police. With one swoosh, you can blind an entire riot cop line and take them out for as long as it takes them to clear their visors. The same goes for police vehicle front windshields. Fireworks are also often shot at police lines, but the few times boat flares have been used, they have been far more effective than fireworks. It's also really important for undercovers and corporate media to be fought out of the demo as soon as things start to get rowdy, to make it safer to eventually disperse and demask. And finally, wearing black socks over shoes and ditching them with everything else can save you a lot of trouble. So can wearing cotton gloves. Yep, that's about it.
Thanks, Nick.
Just heard from the simulator about the Black Block and the simulator Franklin Lopez from Submedia has a new show out, and it's called Locomotive Time Bomb, and it includes information about the students in Mexico who he mentioned, and also the amazing thing that's happening in Kobani in northern Syria at the moment, where fighters are holding out against ISIS, including female militants, and anarchists have crossed over from Turkey to help out defending the Kurdish people in Kobani. So you could go to stimulator.tv to find out all about that. And just another note on the Black Bloc is that there's women involved in the Black Bloc, and there have been people of colour, indigenous people, involved in the Black Bloc. It's not just about privileged white kids getting angry. We're going to hear from Tish Kong now and Smash Things Up. Tish Kong and smash things up. And I guess now's probably a good time, as good a time as any, to say I don't think it's going to happen in Brisbane. What about you, Peter?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
There's all this hype about it.
Yeah.
But really, even like, where in Brisbane is there that much corporate together? Like, I mean, like at the Myer Centre, there's Starbucks and McDonald's, but there's not the numbers. You heard about the Black Bloc. Numbers. There's not the numbers in Brisbane.
We are isolated here out in the Antipodes. We're far from Europe. We're far from America.
But one thing that I should mention also is that some people say, oh, if anyone starts smashing things up, it'll be undercover cops, agent provocateurs. A new perfume, by the way. Agent provocateur. I don't think it would smell very good, but yes. If you see someone, if you go to the People's March starting at 11 a.m. on the Saturday, if someone starts smashing shit up and you suspect it's an undercover cop, you don't know for sure. And this is what happened in Canada. People outed so-called agent provocateurs, and it turned out it wasn't. It was, like, some dude fighting against the system. So, you know, just let people do what, you know, like, oh, yeah, they're doing that. Don't police yourself. I was watching an Adam Curtis documentary about the police inside our heads, policemen inside our heads.
Yeah.
There's no need to police fellow demonstrators' diversity of tactics. If people want to do something that perhaps you're not comfortable with, that's okay, because you're not doing it, they're doing it.
Move away.
It's just like homosexuals.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
For instance.
Yes, Linda.
Yes. Other people can get, you know, if you have a problem with gay marriage, don't worry about it, because you don't have to get,
you don't have to go to the ceremony.
Yes.
You can go to the after party, maybe.
Yeah. Yes. So that's a point there as well. Just let other people, don't try and guess who, I mean, sometimes it's pretty obvious who the undercover people are, but you know, you can't know for sure, and it doesn't really matter.
There have been police provocateurs in Brisbane demonstrations before, I just remembered. And we do have a history in this city of, you know, street marches that were illegal and that, you know, ended in confrontation. So, you know, it's not that we're saying that we shouldn't be assertive, but, you know, it's just, you know, tactical considerations that people should take into account.
But don't go taking pictures of people and outing them as agent provocateurs, because they may not be.
Yes.
It's not cool. We're going to hear now from Maria Delaney, who is an educator and talks about women's rights, works to reduce discrimination, bullying and violence. She has a website called teachjustice.com.au, and she spoke at the Reclaim the Night rally on Friday in Brisbane.
Parents and teachers are keys to social change, and they must be supported by substantial investment in community and school-based education. So, violence supportive attitudes established early in life. Some findings from the research. Researchers found that substantial numbers of boys and young men use physical and sexual violence or report a willingness to do so. 1 in 7 girls and young women aged between 12 and 20, that's 14%, have experienced rape or sexual assault. Around 30% of sexually active year 12 girls have experienced unwanted sex. The average age of a boy's first exposure to pornography is 11. In a 2008 study of 13 to 16-year-old school students, 90% of males and 62% of females reported being exposed to pornography online. It has become more mainstream and also more hardcore. A 2010 study found that 88% of scenes contain physical aggression directed towards the woman. So sex-based harassment is endemic in Australian schools, including physical and sexual intimidation, such as misogynistic name-calling, showing female students pornographic images, and inappropriate touching, groping, and grabbing of girls. This isn't only happening in high school. I want to read you some comments from research from primary school girls. The boys can hurt us so much. We give up. We try as hard as we can. I get very scared of them because I know they can make it so hard for me. Boys tease you about your period, breasts, and what's going to happen to you. If they can, they flick your bra strap. We tease back, but they start it. They say, look at her, she's a dog. They pat their leg and say, come here. I'm pretty heavy up top, and I went home one day and I was crying and that, and all these boys were picking on me, you know, saying, turn your headlights off and all these stupid comments. And I went home and I was crying. Another student in primary school. We try to get the teachers to tell the teachers this. We try to tell them when the boys are teasing or hitting us, but most times they just ignore us. The boys get worse then because they know that they can get away with it. We know the teachers are really busy and don't have a lot of time, but it makes it very hard. We try to put up with the teasing, but when we can't take any more, we just have to stand up for ourselves. When this sort of thing keeps happening, it makes us feel sad and angry and that we can't do our best work at school. The prevention of male violence against women and girls depends on breaking down popular beliefs about gender, what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. We must reject the idea that somehow it's natural or normal for boys and men to be dominant, aggressive, and violent. There is nothing natural or normal about male violence. As our society rejects the stereotype of masculinity, the idea that dominance, aggression, and violence are natural and desirable for men, male violence against other men will also cease. Parents and teachers are key to this social change, and they must be supported by substantial investment in community and school-based education. Violence prevention means working for long-term cultural change. The Australian Education Union Policy on Gender Equity states that gendered violence and sex-based harassment must be eliminated through all educational settings by teaching about the construction of gender, effective communication and relationship skills, conflict management and resolution skills with staff and students at preschools, schools and TAFE institutions. There are countless opportunities within the everyday curriculum and in designated programs for reflection on concepts which expose prejudice and to examine and overturn the negative attitudes that underlie a lot of bullying and violent behaviour. Equally, there are many opportunities to reflect on and foster positive, inclusive and proactive attitudes and behaviours. Awareness-raising campaigns and respectful relationship programs aimed at high school students are not enough. Beliefs about gender and the attitudes that support violent behaviour begin forming in early childhood. We cannot wait until young people are in high school or at university to start talking about this problem. Although communities and schools are very concerned about bullying and violence, they mostly fail to make the connection between bullying and gender construction and patterns of violence in the wider community, even though research shows again and again that most of the bullying is perpetrated by boys against girls and other boys. Unfortunately, most teachers and parents do not possess sufficient knowledge or skills to help young people resist these cultural messages. Finally, I call on government and community organisations to substantially increase support for research-based training for teachers and adequate resourcing of families. And we can all work together to look at masculinity as a social construction, the notion that there are many ways of being male, promote acceptance of different ways of being a male, and challenging negative, restrictive masculinities, offering alternative ways of thinking and behaving. For long-term social change, this is the way we will reclaim the night.
You've been listening to Autonomous Action Radio on Z Digital. For information about the show, you can go to autonomousactionradio.com or 4ZZZFM.org.au.